We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
History in 5 songs. With host Martin Popoff. A production of Pantheon Podcasts. Let's rock out with Martin.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to another episode of History in 5 Songs with Martin Popoff, brought to you by the good people at Pantheon Podcast. Check out all our shows. Just Google us. We're all over the place. There's lots and lots of music shows with the network. We're available on Spotify, iTunes, and over 40 other podcast platforms. All right. So this is episode 221. I'm calling this Recalled Reactions from 1976. To give you a clue what this is about, here's some other titles I was thinking about. Weird First Impressions at 13. First Impressions at 13. First Impressions at 13 in 1976. First Impressions from 1976. Recalled First Impressions from 1976. And I was trying to get the word album into. But no, I think this is perfect. Recalled Reactions from 1976. So the reason I picked this year is because I think this is the first year where I really feel like I remember. I was 13 years old. I remember, getting these new albums and having a reaction. And when I think back to some of these reactions, some of them are bang on and they stayed the same and they stayed consistent. Some of them changed. And again, I think this is also the first year where I feel like there were lots of new releases that I remember getting as new releases and having that reaction. 1975, there's only a handful. 1974, I'm really not feeling, so I'm like 11 years old at that point. I'm really not feeling, I definitely knew that there were a lot of bands I knew about already, even going back to 71, 72. But as new releases, as, you know, getting on this album and, you know, recognizing it as a new release and having an impression, not really. So 1976 is where it all sort of starts. And this is almost like, I almost wanted to get the word reaction into here as well, because those reaction videos thing, we know that that whole thing is overplayed, but some of them have been pretty interesting. I've fallen prey to watching a lot of reaction videos as well. So this is kind of like... the original reaction videos, and this is, of course you can have reaction to new albums going back decades, but for me and our age and kind of where we're at sort of thing, most of us, this for me anyways is a perfect year for that. And like I say, this is almost like true reaction videos. And for some weird reason, I do remember my reaction. I don't know why that is, but this is the sort of thing I definitely do remember. I suppose it's prompted by seeing the song titles and stuff like that. I thought this would be pretty interesting because it's not your tired old ranking of the albums of 1976 or a celebration of that year. This is really about, I'm just going to give you my true feelings of what I remember from these albums from this year. So my true first impressions, whether they were wrong, whether they were right, whether they stuck sort of thing. This is also a strong topic because I went through a lot of bands and realized, there is only a clutch of these that I feel. And when I get to the honorable mentions, they're not really honorable mentions. They're the ones that... are these other records from 1976, and I'm going to tell you, what I remember and why they're not in here, because I'm not really remembering them perfectly. Another point I want to make is this is all pretty much hard rock, nascent heavy metal of some sort, because in 1976, that's all I kind of cared about. So there are a lot of albums I noticed that came out in 76 that I know a lot about now, but I didn't know about then. But that's why this is all coming out that sort of way. So let's take a listen to our first selection and we shall discuss. This is Black Sabbath with You Won't Change Me.
I don't need money and I don't need your life. Yeah. I only need to live for today.
All right, so here we are. Black Sabbath, Technical Ecstasy came out September 25th, 1976, so I'm in Trail, BC. It's fall, it's getting cold, winter's coming, and what a wintry album this was. I definitely remember, I knew every Black Sabbath album by this point, and I definitely remember my buddy Jeff Cahoon getting Sabotage as a new release. Previous to that, I'm not feeling the new releaseness of those Sabbath albums. So, you know, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, I would have been 10 years old. So they're just coming in as a clump, right? Mark Toop, Forrest Toop's brother, my good cousin Lawrence Perpalkin. You know, there were these albums that were out there that they had. I definitely remember Lawrence having some Black Sabbath for sure, and that's probably the first place I heard Sabbath. Also, Tim and Joe Popoff, my cousins. I remember Led Zeppelin specifically with them. Don't quite remember the Sabbath, but Lawrence definitely Black Sabbath. But definitely remember getting this as a new release. And the thoughts on it were that, you know, these are thoughts that pretty much hold up, I would imagine, with this album. So I remember I wanted to pick this song to play because I just remember writing it off as a ballad, even though it's not really a ballad. I love it a lot. I love this song, You Won't Change Me. But I remember... thinking the production was really good, thinking that it was kind of mainstreamy, topic-wise, and the way the songs were arranged, they're not as proggy as you got on Sabotage. I remember loving the heavy songs, Backstreet Kids, of course. But my overall impression was this was just really a depressing, deflated sort of album. It was not a happy album, kind of put you in a depressing mood. Dirty Women and Gypsy is on this. Everything's kind of dark on this album. But it definitely had ballads, and it definitely felt a little commercial. Rock and Roll Doctor felt that way as well. So, you know, my first impressions on this one, possibly not that particularly interesting because they pretty much have stuck with the way it was. I guess my point would be is that even at 13, we kind of knew that Sabbath was a bit on their back foot. With this one. Another one in this category. So I wanted to call this category the first one. I'll read you my notes directly. I already knew this band for sure with actual new releases from 1974 or 1975. So yeah, these are bands that I already, me and my buddies were already well aware of. So in this category, I also want to mention Budgie. If I Were Britannia, I'd Waive the Rules. Bandolier was the first one I got as a new release. Definitely remember getting that at Magic Mushroom Records. But super disappointed at this one. Got this, was so excited about it. Loved that album cover. And it is really quirky and proggy and weird and poppy and fusion-y even. It is not very heavy at all. It was kind of definitely a setback from the first one. Very perplexed, very ticked off. Also in this category, Ted Nugent, Free For All. I didn't look it up, but this was my first big concert. I've told you guys about this many times. Saw it was Rex and then Bebop Deluxe and Ted Nugent all in one show in Spokane, Washington. Went down. Dad took us with a couple of friends. But when Free For All came out, definitely knew the first album already. Maybe even some of those Amboy Dukes ones. My impression of Free For All, we loved it. Me and my buddies loved this album, thought it was great. I don't think we even really particularly glommed on, or I don't remember the story about knowing who Meatloaf was, who this other singer was. There was just this weird voice on it. You know, obviously pre-internet and pre a lot of information. That is an interesting thing now that I think about it, about Free For All. Didn't really clue in on all this singing business, right? What's Ted singing? What is Derek singing? What is this Meatloaf guy singing? We just knew that it was quite technical. There was some really modern thinking heavy metal on this album. I think there were songs on there like Hammerdown and Street Rats that you would probably say that we liked better than almost everything on the Ted Nugent album. So it really seemed like that same shift that you got from Get Your Wings to Rocks. So Ted Nugent to this album, we saw them as a parallel sort of situation. Another one in this category of knowing the band, Rainbow Rising. Got the debut as a new release. Don't remember much about it, about getting it as a new release, but we knew, we were aware of Deep Purple. So Rising, I remember getting that, and you know what? It was not one of the greatest albums of all time for us for a lot of years. I mean, now it's considered one of the great metal albums of all time. The one thing I remember is we were absolutely pleased that there were no mellow songs on it. But being Canadian, being next to the States, being 13, being kids, when you got this very European sort of feel from an album like that, it also felt a little depressing. So it felt a little clanky, depressing. I don't think the production's very good on it. It certainly wasn't up to the standards of Rocks and Free For All. So it came out. It was not your 10 out of 10 record. It was not the greatest band in the world, even though every song was heavy. The other one I remember, is Alice Cooper Goes to Hell. Welcome to My Nightmare. Definitely got that as a new release. I was part of that whole Alice Cooper mania, you know, when the movie came out and he goes solo. See, that's the other thing I didn't really click in on in a huge way, this idea of going solo. It was just like the next Alice Cooper album. But knew all the old stuff. Loved Welcome to My Nightmare to death. This was definitely a big disappointment. It was not as heavy, as cool. It was not conceptual. It was not as spooky and scary that a 13-year-old would like. So that was not a great one either. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Okay, back again here on History in 5 Songs with Martin Popoff, episode 221, Recalled Reactions from 1976. Take a listen to this track and we shall discuss. This is Aerosmith with Lickin' a Promise. All right, so the category here is I knew this band, but I can't remember if this was the first as a true new release or not. So the previous one, I definitely remembered new releases. This one, not so much. Aerosmith Rocks comes out May 3rd, 1976. I absolutely remember this. We loved this album as kids. Forrest Hoop got the first copy of this. I think he picked it up in Spokane. So it came back from one of our legendary, shopping trips in Spokane. But this wasn't one we were together on. This is he's with the family. We played this album, loved it to death, loved the Back in the Saddle, loved Lickin' a Promise, Sick as a Dog, Rats in the Cellar, Nobody's Fault, all these great, great songs on this. Loved that album cover with the, you know, the diamonds there and rocks in, quotation marks, right? The production was amazing. Just loved this album to death. It quickly became immediately our favorite Aerosmith album. One thing I remember about this album is that it took me a long time to get it. I really wanted to own this album. So when he came back from Spokane with it, I don't think it came into Canada for a long, long time. And I just looked up in my cool green book that I kept, like a journal of all this stuff. It's an awesome book. I learned a lot of things even for this episode. But here's one of the cool things I learned. So I remember not having it for a long time and being green with jealousy of Forrest for having it, and we'd have to go to his place to listen to it, etc. We used to lend albums to each other sometimes too, but I remember holding back albums because he didn't want to lend them out. You know, you wanted people had to come to your place to hear it, right? But I just realized that I eventually got my copy in the States as well when we went on a family vacation down the coast, down all through California, Disneyland, just dipped into Mexico, Tijuana, and back. So I got this in San Francisco or LA or something like that. So that's kind of interesting. So this was on that trip. I don't know if you've ever seen that picture of me that I flash around all over the place, of me as a little kid in a Sabotage shirt. It was on that trip. So that's kind of cool. So my copy actually comes from California. Kind of neat. And other ones in this category, Rush 2112. I remember getting this and lo and behold, thought it was heavy, thought it was a masterpiece, thought it was cool. But again, that depressing thing. There's a theme here, right? We had an episode earlier about is this album depressing or whatever, or how I'm depressed by, you know, the early 70s stuff and certainly 60s music, blah, blah, blah. And even those you know, Latin rock tones of Santana, that's a whole nother thing. But 2112, didn't love it. You know, love the heaviness and the amazing drumming and definitely Temples of Syrinx, Something for Nothing, that kind of thing. Yeah, it was a little too conceptual, a little too weird, a little too broken up. You know, really thought they were cool. But was not vaulted to the top of the lists. Sweet Give Us a Wink, I remember, you know, there was, you know, I was part of the Desolation Boulevard mania, you know, the roller rink songs, Fox on the Run, Ballroom Blitz, all that kind of stuff. Give Us a Wink came out and don't really feel like I appreciated the heaviness and the awesomeness of it. It is my favorite Sweet album by a long shot. As you know, I wrote a Sweet book, but it is out of print now, unfortunately. But yeah, there was a Sweet book that I did. So that's one I didn't like all that much at the time, but loved more later on. And I wonder if something this had to do with to do with the idea that even though they were in the magazines a fair bit, moderately, this was not a band that toured here a lot, so they didn't feel part of the North American experience. So it was kind of like a album that was just untethered, just sort of sitting there. It's there. It feels like a baby band, an obscure band. You don't know a lot about them, but there's just this great album. It's a little bit like the Montrose album, I suppose. Led Zeppelin Presence, I honestly don't remember much about that, so I probably shouldn't even talk about it. I don't really remember too much about it as a new release, so we'll leave that one aside. Blue Oyster Cult, Agents of Fortune. Definitely remember this as a new release because I remember having On Your Feet or On Your Knees. That was the album I associate with burning major amounts of incense in my bedroom, listening to that, finding it kind of spooky and old and trapsy and weird. But Agents of Fortune came out and big disappointment, of course, because it's not very heavy, but loved to death. This ain't the Summer of Love. And Tattoo Vampire, definitely, those were really cool. ETI was pretty cool too. Love the, you know, the whole alien Men in Black sort of feel of that. But definitely not a big fan of Blue Oyster Cult too much at this point because this was a pretty mellow album. They were in the magazines a lot. They certainly looked cool. I remember as a 13-year-old thinking this was one of the coolest looking bands there ever was. You know, Eric Bloom with the sunglasses and stuff. All right, let's move on. Third selection here. Take a listen to this. This is Thin Lizzy with Massacre. Feel like sleeping buffalo. Okay, here's an oddball category for you. This is bands that released two albums in 1 year, and I've got three bands in this category to discuss. So Thin Lizzy, honestly don't remember Jailbreak, particularly as a new release, saying, okay, we know the old stuff, here comes Jailbreak, boom, but I definitely remember Johnny the Fox as a new release. And I noted in my little green book, the only words I have by it is Christmas spree. So that must have been a Christmas buying spree. I must have had some Christmas money celebrating Christmas. So I must have bought a few albums at the same time. The album came out October 16th, 76. So there's proof of a bit of a lag of not really getting this particularly as a new release. So it's about 2 months later. Definitely remember really liking it a lot. Loving Thin Lizzy. Loved that album cover. Drew that album cover all over the place. You know, all the Jim Fitzpatrick, you know, lattice work, Celtic artwork, not work, I guess they call it. But yeah, thought that was a really cool album. Loved those songs. Found it also a little bit spooky, a little bit dark. And felt the same way about Jailbreak as well. So, you know, so put it this way, we weren't massive, massive Thin Lizzy fans. And again, it might have something to do with maybe the touring is falling off. They're not really in the magazines a lot. They just feel like a faraway band. Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But yeah, became much bigger Thin Lizzy fans over the years. But I can tell you in 1976 was not the most massive Thin Lizzy fan of all time. Nazareth. Close enough for rock and roll and playing the game. I remember getting both of these and being disappointed by them. Nazareth was a band that was big in Canada, even big in Western Canada. A&M Records, you've heard me talk about this, how they were good with their bands in Canada. But A&M Canada was good with bands in the Canadian territory. So Status Quo got good distribution, even though they weren't coming here. Styx did well here as well. But yeah, just remembered getting these and not particularly liking, much of these albums at all. That album cover on Close Enough for Rock and Roll was super depressing to us. It was just like this rainy, grainy shot of the guys in the car. Playing the Game was not very heavy, but they fell into Playing the Game and Expect No Mercy have the same sort of vibe to them for me of just having two or three heavy songs, and we kind of chucked the rest of it and we're getting ticked off at Nazareth. Kiss Destroyer is one I definitely remember. This is one my memory is sitting there with headphones on and listening to this and loving the new ambitious version of Kiss. I definitely remember, we had Kiss as a new release, Hotter Than Hell, new release, Dressed to Kill, the live album. You've heard my story about that. But Destroyer, so my impressions of that as a 13-year-old was loved the ambition of this, loved the heavy songs, horrified at Beth, horrified at Great Expectations, thought Flaming Youth was a little bit of a sellout as well, quite liked Shout It Out Loud as well, good party sort of tune, versus heavier than the chorus, right? But felt Detroit Rock City, King of the Nighttime World, God of Thunder were like the new masterpieces, better than anything they'd ever done before. So there was that going for it. So yeah, loved the album cover as well. Drew that all over the place as a kid. And then Rock and Roll Over comes out. And I've got to say with this one, my impressions as a 13-year-old, way higher than they are now. This album's consistently gone downhill for me over the years. But loved it at the time. That album cover, I remember seeing it for the first time, blowing my mind. So yeah, that's a band with two albums at the same time. So yeah, Destroyer, loved it to death. It still is, give or take, maybe with Kiss Revenge, my favorite Kiss album of all time. But there's your oddball category. Let's take a listen to our fourth track. Take a listen. This is Judas Priest with Island of Domination. All right, so the category here is new band to me. So this is not the first album by a band, but it's a new band to me and my buddies. So I remember getting this in at Rock Island Tape Center, which I ended up working at. My good buddy Gordon Lee still runs that store today. But yeah, Forrest and I worked there in the record department. We also worked in Kelly's, did some other little work around, some other places. Long story. But definitely ran this record department. Wasn't working there yet at 13. Certainly was by 15, 16, I believe. But got this there, and the impression of this one is the reason I wanted to do this episode, because I love the story of hearing this for the first time. I remember hearing this. John Politano bought the first copy that I realized that I just looked up in my green book. So he got the first copy, and then I must have got a copy immediately after. So fortunately, Rock Island had two copies at least in of this. In Canada, it was on Janus Records. I remember we looked at that album cover and thought, this is almost too fancy for a heavy metal album, so we don't know what this is going to sound like. Turn it over to the back. They kind of look like they're rocking out. There's this religious writing and all these heavy, heavy, titles of songs like Deceiver, Dreamer Deceiver, Epitaph, Genocide, Tyrant, Island of Domination. Everything sounded medieval and timeless and almost religious. So that front cover, the title, Sad Wings of Destiny, when we got out of the wrapper, the fact that it's on a record label we'd never heard of, Janus Records, which has kind of like mythological overtones. It was two-tone brown. And the fact that Rob Halford looked like he had short hair and he was holding a microphone stand over his head that looked almost like a Jesus crucifixion sort of picture. And yes, the religious writing and the name of the band, of course. Yeah, how could I forget that? And just the fact that we knew nothing about them, we were taking this album back to my place to play on the home stereo, what was our address? Woodland Drive, anyways. 293 or 3921 maybe. Anyways, the big, you know, dad built the house, right? So we got the big vaulted double height ceiling with the cool red modular fireplace with the double length red chimney that goes all the way to the top inside the house. It was quite a technological thing dad built with this and the two types of circular staircases that he built as well. So yeah, this was a completely family built house. Anyway, so yeah, we had the main stereo there, and I remember sitting down listening to this thinking this could be a Christian rock album and not a heavy metal album. Put it on, we were absolutely blown away. It vaulted to the top of all our lists that we would sit and do of top 10 singers and top 10 riffs and albums and heaviest songs of all time. I remember we just sat there like going, well, who is this baby band? And we were like almost scaring ourselves. I remember my little brother Brad, rest in peace. He's passed on, died at the age of 49, almost made it to his 50th birthday, had a lot of health problems over the years. But I remember him crying because we were all like kind of spooked by this album. We were spooked by how good it was. We were spooked by how completely professional and how this baby band was better than every other band we knew, all these veteran bands, because that's how we felt. You know, you had a lead singer who was this operatic technical singer that was way different than every other heavy metal singer. Every single riff on this album was more complicated and cooler than every Black Sabbath riff, who were probably the second reigning kings of the riff. It was proggy. Again, it was super timeless. So that was a really cool thing. So that came out March 25th, 76. Boy, other ones in this category. The only other one I can think of to put in this category was Scorpion's Virgin Killer. So didn't know the band. Got this in 1976, and I remember playing it at Forrest Hoop's place for the first time. And our impression was that similar to Judas Priest, so we had the German thing happening for the very first time with the band. So this is a German band. We recognized by reading everything on it that it was a German band. But it was really patchy, a little bit behind the times, a little bit weird, a little bit krautrock, even though we didn't know what krautrock was. But it had Virgin Killer on it. It had that song that was so violent and scrapey and weird and chaotic that it felt like the heaviest song we'd ever heard. But it was only heavier than Judas Priest because it was kind of less polite than Judas Priest. It was like Judas Priest of Hellbent for Leather era versus Sad Wings, right? And then, yeah, had some other pretty cool songs on it, Catch Your Train, Pictured Life. It was a little gothic, a little spooky, a little weird. But yeah, we thought it was exotic. You could hear the exoticness of the Germanness of it. We noticed that right away. And then we did a weird thing. We used to do these album trades, and I traded it. I had bought that, and he had bought Yesterday and Today, Yesterday and Today as our two risks for the day. And we brought them home, like not knowing these bands. And we played each of them. And I expressed some greater like for the first Yesterday and Today album. And Forrest expressed some greater like for Virgin Killer. And this was one of our simplest trades. It was a straight swap. You know, and it felt really weird, right? We both spent $6.99. You're supposed to champion your own album, and all of a sudden we're swapping these. But more on that later, because I've got Y&T, or Yesterday and Today, sorry, in the next category. All right, so our last category for the day is new band, period. This is their debut. So take a listen to this. This is Boston with Hitch a Ride. All right. So the funny thing with Boston is I'm doing this because I never owned this album, because this is the mellowest thing on this list. So we would not buy a Boston album. So I can't remember who owned it, but we heard it right away. Somebody owned it because I noticed up. I noticed looking up in my green book that the first time I owned this album was February 1st, 1981. I got it from Jeff Lakes up the street. Jeff Lakes, tragically, was one of at least five climbers who died on K2 in 1995. So he was a cool, you know, kind of mellow, quiet, long-haired, stonerish kind of kid in school. You know, he hung out with the rougher crowd kind of thing. But I commandeered this big deal with him and bought... So in 1981, beginning of 81, I bought a crate or two of records from him. I remember that's how I got Montrose for the first time. And I bought his pretty scrappy, mismatched small drum set from him. So that's how I ended up with my first copy of Boston in 1981. So 5 years later, I get my very first copy of Boston. But I remember at the time, our thoughts on this record were... A major jealousy that it was doing so well and taking sales away from heavier albums. That's a theme that happens with Styx. It happens later with Loverboy. It happens later with Foreigner. But the other thing we felt about this record is we loved the heaviness of the Tom Scholz guitar tone. So we noticed that there was a sort of heaviness to this album, but everything else was working against it to make it not heavy. So the overall production, the drum sound, the Brad Delp singing, and the melody and the mellowness of the song. So it was almost like... there was one thing keeping one foot in our heavy metal category, and that was the guitar sound. So we're kind of on board. We had friends that liked it. Most of us, it was a badge of honor not to like the Boston album, so we did that. So other ones in this category, Triumph, definitely remember that as a new release, and thinking it was okay, not great. Canadian band, good to see. Previous to this, all we had was BTO, April Wine, and Rush, and this was a pretty heavy album for 1976. Stars, definitely remember this as a new release because, of course, they were heavily promoted in Circus and Cream and Hit Parader. I'm looking at my copy right now as I speak, you know, with the embossed, the big yellow logo on black, the really dramatic looking, you know, soft but cool looking band photo on the back. And this was simply another version of Kiss type music. So you had, but it was like your thinking man's Kiss and Kiss without makeup. So you had Boys in Action was a good heavy one on this. Now I Can was a good heavy one on this. Tear It Down, Nightcrawler, Monkey Business, Livewire, Detroit Girls. Detroit Girls was pretty heavy. So they were like a cross between Kiss, New York Dolls, Aerosmith, that sort of thing. Maybe the songwriting was not as good, certainly, as Aerosmith, but it's produced by Jack Douglas, produced really well. So that's what I remember thinking of Stars. We were hoping, this was our band, so this was like a new band right when we were kids, so that felt kind of cool. So we were championing Stars, hoping the best for them. When Violation came out, we even liked that even better, and it is a better album. So that's one in that category. I mentioned Yesterday and Today, so that's a new band with a debut. Our thoughts on that as kids was that this was a little dated sounding. The production was a little rough. It was a little bassy and boomy, a little chaotic. It didn't feel like it was strapped together as well as our favorite professional bands like Ted Nugent and Aerosmith as a good comparative. So yeah, that thing came out. And it just became an album we liked. It was kind of a 7 out of 10. Stars would have been maybe a 7 out of 10 because it wasn't particularly heavy. Tribe, maybe even a 6 out of 10. Boston would have been your 3 out of 10. Yeah, something else I wanted to go through in this episode, but we're out of time. This was long again, was our whole rating system thing. I could probably give you the ratings of every single song on this from memory using our rating system. So yeah, the other one in this, Runaways, getting that as a new release, remember that, and thinking that was a pretty heavy album that sounded like Stars, Kiss, Stars, Kiss, Moxie, Triumph maybe, New York Dolls a little bit. So that was a good album that we liked right out of the gates. You know, that's a pretty heavy album for 1976, all-girl band, of course. And then the other ones that I felt like I couldn't talk about because I didn't feel really fit with this, I have absolute recollections of it, but these are albums that come out in 76, are UFO No Heavy Petting. AC/DC High Voltage, you know my situation there. I ended up getting that, I believe, at the same time as Let There Be Rock in Winnipeg, and getting that home from this cross Canada country family trip. And then, so it's a little bit of a mess, but in 76, you've got the domestic High Voltage, but you've also got the Australian Dirty D's Dunder Cheap. And I knew nothing about that. Like, forget Australian airport, imports for me in 76, not a possibility, not a reality. But the funny thing I just realized, looking in my green book, I didn't realize that I got Sin After Sin at that same store on that same trip. So this would be Kelly's in Winnipeg in 1977. So that was the fall. That was the one I was dying to hear the most from that trip to get back. I mean, already knowing Sad Wings, sitting there waiting for another 2 weeks of travel to get home, hoping your record didn't melt in the back of the green Dodge van. So yeah, that one was 77. Sammy Hagar 9 on a 10 scale, don't really remember. Status Quo Blue for you, don't really remember. Your Eye Heap High and Mighty, don't remember. Styx, wasn't really a fan. Tejas, don't remember that as a new release. Foghat Night Shift, we are Foghat fans. These are all bands we knew about and had an album or two already. Well, obviously not Sammy Hagar solo. Queen Day at the Races, don't really particularly remember that as a new release. And I'm amazed to see that the Pat Travers debut album is 76. I always think of that as older than that. So that's your not honorable mentions in the honorable mentions slot. If you like this show and want to support future episodes, you can go to ko-fi.com/MartinPopoff, hit that red support button, buy me a coffee or a pint. On this week, the list is a little longer because it is one where I reminded you all at the Facebook page and on my regular page. So this week, I'd like to thank Andy at Black Sugar Transmission, our favorite rock star as part of the family here. You know, Blondie, KMFDM, Lee Clifford, David Fisher, Monty Olson, Daryl Oon, Augustine Garcia de Paredes, Philip Edward Phyllis, Steve Polari, Patrick Stevens, and William Walker. Thank you all. Exciting time for books right now. The new Who book, my big plush Who Quadrophenia book, is in stock. I can ship those right now. And also my Bluish Occult panel book, which turned out really, really good. Dominance and Submission, the Bluish Occult canon. And I've got the paperback versions of the Hawkwind visual biography, the Nazareth visual biography, and the Emerald new version of the old Jailbreak Dublin to Jailbreak book. So that's all available at martinpopoff.com. Hope you enjoyed this episode. It was nice reminiscing about 1976 with you. But like I say, as the episode title says, recalled reactions from 76, wrong or right. Most of them turned out to be right. Ossified, you know, I guess cast in stone from that time. Maybe you don't change your mind particularly. Few went up, few went down, but it's nice to see that, me and my buddies were not completely clueless at 13 years old about these albums. We kind of already had this whole thing figured out for, you know, a good 24, 36 months of super intense fandom by this point already. There you go. For homework, you know, go play some Black Sabbath Technical Ecstasy. That album deserves a little more love.
Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at R&R Archaeology.